there, dolls, music lovers, and fashion enthusiasts. Welcome to Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s, the podcast that takes you on a groovy journey through the lives and legacies of the incredible women who shaped these iconic decades. We are your hosts, Emma
and Abby,
and together we'll explore the stories behind the music, the fashion, and the cultural revolution that defined an era.
Each episode will shine a spotlight on a remarkable woman, from rock and roll rebels to fashion icons, and dive into their impact on the world. We'll also uncover the historical context and celebrate the lasting influence of these trailblazing ladies. So, grab your bell bottoms and get ready to rock and roll as we uncover the untold stories of dolls who left their mark. Let's dive in.
So, last night I saw Bob Dylan.
How was it?
Everything I could have wished for and more.
That's so great.
I thought it was so good. It was in this like really big arena almost. I think they're able to like fit 6,000 people in there or something. And it was packed. I don't think it was fully sold out, but it was definitely full. There were like a couple of seats empty, but a lot of people came out. And I loved that he like kept it. I mean, I didn't expect him to have a stage show, but he really did the most minimalist approach to a show one could do. But I really like that, honestly.
He's in his 80s by now, you know? He's so chill.
But he had these like old huge lamps on the stage, these like big spots, and it made for this like really nice warm colored light, and then it was just him and a couple of musicians, and he started with All Along the Watchtower.
No way. So that's what I was gonna ask you, like, what did you get on your set list? Because it's a total grab bag. You could get the hits, or you could get like random stuff from the 90s and 2000s. What did you get?
It was more that he started with All Along the Watchtower, which to me, that song is so memorable. Like, the intro starts and you already know what it is, but he put his Bob Dylan twist, so it took people a minute to get there. He did a really great rendition of that, I thought. He played It's All Over, Baby Blue.
Love that song. That song.
I was secretly hoping that he would play my all-time favorite Dylan song, Hurricane, because it's just such a good track. I love it. He didn't, which was fine. He played actually quite a bit of this, like, the new album. It's not that new anymore, but, like, the most recent one.
It was, like, 4 years ago now, right?
Yeah, I think so. But this tour has been going on since 2021. So this is, like, the tour in collaboration with that record. But, yeah, I thought it was really good. He went on stage 8 p.m. sharp, and he left by, like, 10. It was a very, like, sparse show. He just went on there, started to play, no introduction, nothing. Then after a couple of songs, he, like, said three sentences, was like, these are the people playing with me tonight. Mm-hmm. And then at the end of the show, he just stopped, like, the last song. Then they stood on stage maybe for, like, 10 seconds. Then the lights went off, and everyone was clapping, hoping for some sort of, like, comeback, another little song. No. All of a sudden, they just, like, turned the light on back, and that's it. But it was great. I really, really loved it. And I actually had the sweetest little thing on the way out. So we walked out and then we waited for the train. And next to us sat this woman who looked, I don't know how to describe it, just very classic older lady. She was wearing like a pair of older lady pants and like a nicely, like a shirt with some sort of pattern on it. And I was talking to my dad because we had gone to the show together. And then she was like, well, actually, I would like to talk with you. It was really sweet. She just started to join our talking. She just got in there. And she was like, well, I'm 83 too. And I have to say, I'm not that advanced with Bob Dylan's music because I'm actually a big fan of Pink Floyd and Black Sabbath. That's where I really know my music. It was so funny.
So like coolest old lady ever.
Yes, but she did not. I don't mean this in any condescending way, but like she did not look like someone I'd imagine listening to Black Sabbath. But maybe she looked like that back in the day. I don't know. It's not about looks. But she was just so sweet. And then she was like, well, I'm Bob Dylan's age and his music has always been part of my life. And he has been there with me through all the seasons of life. And I thought, I just come out here now. And this was the first time that she saw him live. And she was so excited.
That's so sweet.
I love that.
How did your dad like it?
He loved it. He had seen Dylan perform last in 2007. And he was blown away once again. He really did love it.
That's so sweet.
Yeah, it was so, so good. Also, the age demographic of that concert. Maybe 10% of people in that room did not have gray hair yet. It was definitely... But it was so fun because there were like a couple of people who were definitely in their 70s. And they were all wearing these like old Bob Dylan shirts from like way back.
I love when people do that.
Me too. And I heard this one couple talking about how they had last seen him in 1972.
Last seen him? Like hadn't seen him in 50 years?
Yes. They were like, oh, remember how... But they had gone there together apparently on that show too. It was so sweet. I think everyone had a great night.
Uniting the generations under Bob Dylan's music. Yes. Love to see it.
Who else could do that?
Love to see it. I remember going out to the restaurant before I saw Dylan in 2019, and I would see people milling about in like shirts that said Highway 61, and they all had like gray hair, and they were all over the age of 50. And they would... It was just such a great sight to... you know, see people around the city and just kind of know that they're going to be in the same place as you in a couple hours.
Oh, yeah. It was very apparent even like walking up there who was going to go to that concert. And what actually was quite funny, right in front of the arena where he was playing, there was this street musician who looked a whole lot like Bob Dylan. He definitely had like a Bob Dylan impersonator thing about him. And he was playing all the Dylan songs in the classic Dylan way because... Dylan himself does not do that. This man made, I believe, so much money in tips last night. It was crazy.
Honestly, you're more likely to get the hits from a Bob Dylan cover band than you are from the man himself these days.
Oh, yeah. But it was so sweet because it was quite warm last night. The only downside about this concert was that there were only seats available. So no one really danced. But as we were leaving, a lot of people were like gathering around the street musician and like dancing on the street.
Oh, that's
which was
so
really beautiful.
I love that.
It was like the greatest atmosphere.
Like I've great interactions after Dylan concerts. I've noticed that pattern. Like you with the street musician, and I ran into like some Grateful Dead roadies who gave me this awesome tie-dye t-shirt.
That's great.
They were like making tie-dye of this Dylan tour. I saw him on the Never Ending tour. So it had like all of these dates from like the 80s on it, and they complimented my Penny Lane coat. They were so cool.
That's so sweet.
Let's jump into this. I'm really excited for this. I knew next to nothing about today's doll before getting this script, so I'm really excited to teach everybody else about her.
Me too. Today's doll is as much a legend as she is a myth, but she truly lived one of the most adventurous lives I've ever heard of, from living in a commune to traveling the world on a bus on the hippie trail to all the nights she spent with the Rolling Stones. This episode is all about Uschi Obermeier. Most of today's episode comes from her memoirs titled High Times, Mein wildes Leben, which unfortunately is only available in German. I've translated certain sections and quotes for you, and I try to keep them as close to the original as possible, but just know that this isn't like a quote-unquote quote, if that makes sense.
Uschi was born Ursula Obermeier on September 24th, 1946 in Munich, Germany. It had been less than a year since World War II ended and Munich was in ruins. Sendling, the part of Munich the Obermeiers lived in, was a working-class neighborhood. Uschi's parents were young when they had her. Her dad was 19 and her mom had just turned 22. She was mostly cared for by her mother and she was a sickly child. She was born with a hip defect that required her to wear big leg braces for several years as a child. With her braces on, she couldn't run or play with the other neighborhood kids. Instead, she would lay on her bed for days on end, looking out the window and dreaming of adventures she could have. Uschi's parents were about as polar opposite as possible. Her mother was a housewife who sewed all her clothes herself. Meanwhile, her father was a total character, it sounds like, who wore oversized suits and Italian shoes, kind of like a zoot suit, I imagine. Uschi adored her father, Max. He was wild, a blonde, handsome man with a quiff, but he had a tendency of cheating on Uschi's mom. Max was one of six children, that might explain his big personality.
Yeah.
His father owned a popular fabric for mannequins. Actresses from all over the country would visit Ushi's grandfather to get mannequins made after them. Would this be to, like, make custom dresses for movie premieres and things?
I think so. I think it was also for museums and, like, exhibitions they did with the dresses that people wore in the movies. And I also think it was a thing back then, because I've seen this from, like, a lot of old videos from London, that a lot of people had mannequins who looked like Twiggy. And maybe this was kind of the thing that was going on there, too, that just, like, popular German actresses and models would get mannequins made after them to then be put into different stores.
All right. This mannequin business would explain Max's eye for fashion. He was a decorator and made good money working for some of the best shops in Munich.
This is actually very rare that someone in the late 1940s was making a good living, because this is like post-war Germany. Everything is bombed. Even if you think about how she grew up compared to Nico, this is a whole different story. Even though she's not that much younger, it's just over this like short period of time a lot changed. The Obermeyers were actually pretty well off regarding financial situations at the time. Ushi's life mainly took place in three German cities, all completely different from the others. Munich was and still is a pretty chic city. And even in shatters after being bombed during the war, the city kept its appeal. Located in southern Germany, it has always been a wealthy area. A lot of sophisticated people lived there, but it was also stuffy, and that kind of stuffiness drove young Ushi mad. Her parents eventually split and Ushi lived with her mother. She still met up with her dad regularly, who always talked bad about her mother.
That's unfortunate.
Even though Ushi had always felt closer to her father, she made it a point in her biography to say that her mother never spoke a bad word about her father. When she was 13, she left school and wanted to be a decorator just like him. To that, her mother responded, in quotes, "You're already so sloppy and don't have your things together. They are also sloppy, the decorators." And forbade her to pursue it. She was too young to go to graphic art school, so the only thing that was left for her to become was a retoucher. For her first day, her mother bought her a purse and a new lacy bra. From the first second, she hated it. The job required her to get up at 5 a.m. to take the train all across the city, and she felt like her life was dictated by someone else.
So this sounds like she was working as like a retouching assistant position in like a photo studio?
Yes.
Okay.
From my understanding, that's basically it.
Ushi never took well to answering to other people, but for the next 3 years, she made hundreds of coffees, cleaned thousands of paint buckets, and fixed mistakes on photo negatives. One day, she took her own picture and retouched it to what she thought was perfection. Later, she wrote she ended up looking exactly that, perfect. Ushi felt trapped in her work and in Munich. She said about the city, quote, "Nothing ever happened and nothing will ever happen. The one thing she truly enjoyed was music. It felt like an escape to her. She loved to dream of an adventurous life on the run." When young Ushi started dating, the men she went out with were quite similar in personality to her father, quick-thinking, fashionable, and fun. She could pinpoint exactly who the life of the party was and move right in on him, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah.
Quote, "My motto always was, I don't want your money, I want your honey. That's why I never wanted a doctor or a lawyer as a husband. For me, only a wild man came into question." When Ushi was 15, she started to go to the Big Apple, not New York City,
a
basement bar in Munich where people would dance and drink all night long. Ushi was ecstatic. This was truly different from everything she knew. It was fast-paced, exciting, and there were always new faces to meet. One night, while dancing at the club, she met a group of people who would soon become her friends. One of them, Biggie, was a nurse who had the keys to the pharmacy cabinet at the hospital. Soon, Ushi began taking amphetamines. Biggie would sneak out of the pharmacy. This reminds me of Pamela DeBar talking about her experiences with Trimar in her book I'm with the Band. She made friends with, like, the bassist of Iron Butterfly, and he had this hospital job, and he'd smuggle Trimar out. This truly only could have happened in California in the late 60s. Yeah. But I guess not, because now it's happening again.
Yeah.
Around the time she discovered the Big Apple Club, a photographer came up to Uchi on the street. He asked her if she was interested in becoming a model. It was the mid-1960s, right around the time paper dresses were all the rage. And he photographed her in a couple of those. Uchi was a natural in front of the camera. Soon, her pictures were published in Bravo, a popular teen magazine in Germany, with the words, "Beauty Tips for Young Girls," above it.
I bet she loved that.
So demure compared to the headlines she will be known for in a few years.
Oh, yeah. During this time, she also participated in a beauty contest for Miss Schwabinchen. She got second place and won a vacation to Italy. When she came back, she moved out of her mom's house in Sendling and into the city. Every night, she would go out on town, and soon everyone knew who this dark-haired, beautiful girl was. Around that time, she also tried LSD for the first time, in quotes. "I had all these excessive expectations, but they were just disappointed. Yes, actually, I was disappointed." I love that.
Imagine being disappointed by LSD in 1966.
I love that. She wrote in her biography that back then, her favorite record was by the Velvet Underground. Soon afterwards, she met Neil of the Flower Pot Men, a band of studio musicians, and Neil fell for Uchi the moment he saw her. This is something that'll come up a lot in this story. Mm-hmm. Men just looked at her and were in love. It's mm-hmm. unbelievable. He wrote her telegrams and invited her to come on tour with him. One day, he sent her an airplane ticket to London, and of course she went. In quotes, "Swinging London was truly amazing. The streets were filled with people dressed in eclectic clothes and everyone seemed so creative. The scene was bursting with strange figures and bizarre personalities. London was definitely the place where all streets met. And every boutique was playing music. And for the first time, it was our music. London belonged to the youth. At least Kings Road did. Something new was in the air. Something that no one knew and that wasn't rooted in the past. Like psychedelic music. The early Pink Floyd stuff with Syd Barrett. It was no comparison to Germany, where I was yelled at by a woman on the subway who got mad because I wore a miniskirt." I love how she described London.
Mm-hmm.
Neil knew Jimi Hendrix, and because Jimi was on tour, Uchi and Neil stayed at his house. They took acid together, and why she felt like Neil started to fall in love with her even more, she felt alienated while high. One night, while they were out on the town, she met David Bailey, the star photographer who made Gene Shrimpton and Twiggy popular.
Yeah.
He truly was the photographer of the time.
Mm-hmm.
He's also the one Blow Up the movie is based on.
Really?
Yes.
Huh.
They didn't say it, but a couple of years mm-hmm. later, the director admitted that this was kind of like a portrait on David Bailey.
Now that I think of it, there's like just enough identifying clues to kind of leave mm-hmm. that ambiguous, but I can definitely see how that was based on him.
And of course, Uchi immediately gave him her number. When he called the next day, Neil picked up and he didn't tell Uchi. When she found out, she left him.
What is with men on this podcast answering calls meant for their girlfriends and not telling them? This is the second time this has happened yes. now. It happened first with Rita Coolidge, Stephen Stills, and Graham Nash. And now it's happening with Uchi, Neil, and David Bailey.
It's so wild because why didn't he want her to succeed in what she wanted to do?
I don't know.
She wasn't taking anything away from him.
These men. I'm so sorry if there's going to be a hum, by the way. Somebody in the far, far distance is blowing leaves at 10 o'clock in the morning on a Tuesday.
If you got nothing else to do, then do that.
Truly. After coming back from London, she found Germany had changed. It was finally, hopefully, catching up with the times. The Academy of Arts in Munich was set to host the first pop art festival in the country. It was an outdoor happening with live art, poetry reading, and the band Amandul set to play. Is that even close?
Yeah, I would say it's Amandul. But this is not a German word. This is a fantasy word. Okay. These are not words.
It is?
It doesn't mean anything. These are just weird words. I have no clue.
When Usheep first heard Amon Jewel play, she was hooked. She couldn't believe that a band from Germany was so good. They sounded like the American and British bands that she liked. Their sound was psychedelic, heavy, and loud, with two drummers on stage. Right as they were done playing, Ushi made her way backstage. One of the drummers, his name was Peter, told Ushi that the band lived in a commune. All the money they made from gigs was put in a pot where members would take from to get groceries and other things they needed. Everyone cared for each other like one big family. All of a sudden, the luxury of having a telephone next to the bathtub didn't seem so great anymore. Ushi wanted to live on a commune too. So she up and quit her job to live with Amon Jewel. I took like a quick scan of her Wikipedia page. It says she like played some percussion on their records.
She played the maracas and percussion because she said that she is not a very musical person. Like she said that about herself. She doesn't have like any talent in that direction, she meant. But she just liked to be there for the fun. I feel like this is something that'll come up a lot in this story. She just likes to live in a moment, and she tries all these different things, and this is not about her trying to have a music career. I'm sure she didn't go with them because she was actually interested in becoming a musician.
She just did it for the plot.
Yeah, her entire life could be summed up as she did that for the plot.
There were no such thing as obstacles for Ushi Overmeyer.
Absolutely
not. No. Upon arrival, Ushi was greeted with open arms by a woman wearing nothing but underpants and a t-shirt. Ushi found that insanely cool. We see, sort of, in her career, like the height of her career, she's kind of allergic to clothes.
Yes.
So I think she, like, picked that up from this lady who greeted her.
Oh, yeah. And I think it was also so different to how she'd grown up in this, like, stuffy neighborhood where probably everyone pressed their underwear every morning and, like, wore layers upon layers of perfectly fitted clothes. Yeah, probably.
In the commune, they smoked joints all day long and made music together. Quote, everyone just drummed on anything. I couldn't play anything besides the maracas, but those I played loud and plenty. I was still working as a model on the side, and I was proud when I got some money to put into the community fund. The music in England and America moved away from the beat and flower power phase and got more and more exquisite and militant. We listened to lots of Love and Dr. John and also MC5's Kick Out the Jams Motherfucker and Blue Cheer. I almost wore my MC5 shirt today because I'm such a fake fan, Emma. I don't have a Rolling Stones t-shirt, which I totally would have worn that.
I don't either.
Ah,
I was looking through my closet. I was like, do I have anything that fits the occasion? But I don't. In September of 1968, she met Rainer Langhans, the first man Ushi fell in love with.
I never would have guessed that name was pronounced that way.
It's actually a name that is very popular in, like, my parents' generation.
Okay. That's a name that doesn't exist here. Unless you're some eccentric, vaguely European millionaire, then I can imagine you having that name.
That is so wild, because Rainer here is the equivalent to maybe Jeff or John. It's like a very classic dad name.
Jeff.
There are millions upon millions of Rainers here,
you're right.
I'm sure.
Jeff is such a classic dad name. Like Jeff and Dave.
It's so funny that you thought that that sounded so eclectic, because when I first read that in the book, I was like, man, that does not sound like a cool guy. He was part of the Kommune Eins, the first ever and most popular commune in Germany. And something about him fascinated Ushi deeply. In quotes, they didn't look like politicians, but more like rockstar hippies. But still, they were in politics. Rainer had the longest and most beautiful hair, and he had stopped washing it a couple of months ago. Actually, if you look at pictures of him now, he stayed true to that haircut. He still looks the same. He kind of did what Brian May of Queen did, where you once get a hairstyle and you just stay with it for life.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at Reiner's 60s hair. I just thought, like, is this man, is this John Sinclair?
He had majestic
with the round
hair.
Glasses and the big hair. He looks like John Sinclair.
He really does. The Kommune Eins was on the news every single day with their happenings and outrageous lives. It was 1968, and the political climate in Germany was tense. There was a rise in political protests, notably the German student movement, which opposed the Grand Coalition government, perceived as repressive, and pushed for more democratic reforms. Many younger students started to question their parents' past in Nazi Germany, and that led to a huge rift in the country. This is interesting.
Here, our big generational rift was over Vietnam.
Yeah.
And yours was over reckoning with World War II. Looking at 1968, it was such a pressure cooker year for everyone, it seems.
Yeah.
There was stuff going on in Britain. There was a whole lot going on in the States. There was a lot going on in Germany.
Mm-hmm. The issue mainly was that while the Nazis were reigning the country, basically, at least publicly, everyone was kind of okay with it, because if you weren't, it ended deadly for you.
Yes.
And then after the war ended, most Germans were like, well, we never knew that all of that with the Jews was going on. They just kind of like pretended like no one knew what was going on and no one had any sort of responsibility for it. And when that generation of people born after the war, mainly like the people who went to university in the late 1960s, when they started to question, they pretty early on realized that this couldn't have been the case. If no one knew what was going on, Hitler, all of that couldn't have ever worked out. And so it caused this big rift. And like a lot of the people who were born in Uschi's generation are definitely more far left.
Yeah.
That entire idea of like being leftist, as far as that was a thing back then, it stems from that time. And that was kind of like tied in with the hippie movement and
the rise of the counterculture in Germany. This is everywhere. What we mean when we say in our intro, uncovering the historical context.
Yes, it was truly a really interesting time to be alive, because when I talked to my dad about this yesterday, we talked a little about Uschi's life, and the Kommune Eins is still very popular. It isn't a thing anymore. They kind of like fell apart, I think, even in the early 70s already. But it's kind of like the only commune to ever have existed here, like the only very popular one. And so everyone kind of knows the story. Here in Germany, people know Uschi from Kommune Eins. They do not know her for like being with the Rolling Stones. She's definitely perceived different here than she is in the United States. But when I talked to my dad about it, he was like telling me about the kind of life that his parents had in the late 60s in Germany, which they lived on the countryside, got married young, had three kids, lived this really classic kind of like picture book regular life. And it is so interesting that not far from them, this was going on. Kommune Eins was a radical left-wing commune established in West Berlin in 1967. It became a symbol of countercultural rebellion against the conservative and capitalist order in post-war West Germany. The group embraced free love, communal living, and political provocation, often staging shocking public events to criticize consumerism and authoritarian structures. And all of a sudden, Uschi was in the middle of all of that. She decided to follow Rainer to West Berlin, to live there with him. This was the second city in Germany she lived in, and as mentioned prior, a truly different place from Munich. Because Germany was divided, West Berlin was a special place. Located in eastern Germany, it belonged to the West, and to get there, you had to cross the border, drive through eastern Germany, then cross the border again to get into West Berlin. West Berlin was a hotspot for political activism and counterculture, isolated by the Berlin Wall and surrounded by communist East Germany. It attracted students and radicals, becoming a center for protests against capitalism, authoritarianism, and the Vietnam War. The city's unique Cold War status fostered a rebellious avant-garde atmosphere with a thriving alternative cultural scene in music, art, and activism. My dad actually told me about how this must have been in like the mid 80s. He went to West Berlin because you could just go there because it was a part of West Germany. But you had to drive through Eastern Germany, which there was only one street and you were not allowed to leave that street in no case. And he said it was so strange because they were really, really strict, because a lot of people tried to flee Eastern Germany and like they would hide in the cars, and so they would do these like insane checks,
checkpoints.
Yes, They had insane checkpoints, and you were like scanned in the way that you get scanned now at an airport to just leave the country and get back in. And it is so interesting because I lived in Berlin for a while, and you just have to imagine that you live in an area and right across the street, there are people who have always been there. And one day someone puts up a wall and those people live in a different country. And they're still just across the street. It is so wild. But it made West Berlin this really interesting place to be because it was so small. And it was just this like booming cultural place. It also at that point was not the capital of Western Germany. So it really just was this like artsy, fun place for people to go.
Kommune 1 was located in a loft in Moabit. Their approach to communal living was pretty extreme. There was zero privacy for anyone. All the doors were taken off their hinges. Even the toilet had no door. And put a pin in that toilet door detail for later. They believed that nothing should be private, especially not politics. For the first couple days she lived there, Ushi would get up before everyone else to quickly do her makeup in the bathroom. You know, for like a single moment of peace.
I would get that.
It's like, just like imagine you're a college girl in like a communal dorm and you have to like get up for your 8 a.m. class to do your makeup. But instead of like an all girls floor, it's like a whole building of friggin' hippies. It's like that.
Yes. And she was also probably the only person there to even wear makeup.
I didn't think of that. You're right.
Yes. They always got mad at her because they always thought that she was so vain. Yeah. They always told her she's not a real hippie because she's so much into her appearance. Whereas Rainer decided to just not wash his hair for years on end. I don't want to know what the smell was in there.
Hippies smelled so bad. They smelled so bad.
Yes.
Like, I don't know if this was a thing for Kommune 1, but the White Panthers got it in their head that, like, wearing underwear was counter-revolutionary, so the five just like stopped wearing underwear, and they would wear their pants so tight, and they'd be doing that crazy stuff on stage, and there were a few moments where they like ripped their pants and got charged for obscenity.
That's so funny.
Just the smell of no underwear and so much pot, that's the smell of the commune.
I bet so.
Rainer was intelligent and quite intense. She loved how seriously he took her. He seemed to be interested in her true self, not the pretty model girl who worked as an apprentice in a studio. He asked her about every detail of her life, and they'd stay up all night just talking in bed and smoking lots and lots of pot. Rainer trusted Ushi's instincts. He took gut feelings very seriously. Before events, he'd ask her for her opinion and trusted her. If the vibes were off, it was a no-go. Like the 1968 version of like the vibe check before you go out at night.
But this also caused a rift between Rainer and a couple of the other people living there because they were like, why are you trusting this woman who is not even interested in politics with what we are all as a communal group are doing?
Every morning, they'd get all the newspapers available to see what was written about them. But they were also judgmental, and Ushi didn't get along well with everybody, like you said. Here's the thing about Ushi. Though she was with Rainer, she wasn't interested in politics at all. She was just there for him, and some members of the commune did not like that. She bought a can of Coke once, and they told her she was counter-revolutionary. She bought menthol cigarettes instead of rolling her own, which, in their eyes, made her counter-revolutionary. Ushi was still working as a model, and even though it made good money for the commune, they thought she was vain and, you guessed it, counter-revolutionary. But Ushi didn't really care what others thought of her. She was just there for Rainer. Later, in an interview, she called herself a narcissist and once again stated she didn't care for politics. You can hear her strong Bavarian accent in this clip, which we really get a kick out of.
In Berlin?
Naja, erst am Schluss.
Ja, und heute sind Sie ein Top-Fotomodell. Also etwas, was sich eigentlich ja mit den Ideen der APO oder auch einer Kommune nicht unbedingt deckt. Das heißt, Sie haben heute einen Beruf, der, wenn ich es vorsichtig formulieren darf, eigentlich ein reiner Geldverdienberuf ist. Oder sehe ich es vielleicht ganz falsch?
Ach ja, nee, stimmt auch, aber es ist halt für mich, also ich bin ja ein Narzisstenalter und da ist es ja auch für mich ganz gut, ne?
It's so funny because she still gets invited to talk shows every now and then. And they always asked her about the Kommune Eins and her political views. And she just has been repeating ever since the late 60s how she does not care for politics. She didn't back then and she does not now.
Another thing the members of the commune didn't like was how Uschi became the figurehead for them. Rainer and her were soon somewhat of an ick couple and the de facto faces of Kommune Eins. They were pictured on magazine covers, topless and rolling joints. If you'd ask a German what Uschi Obermeier is known for, they'd probably say these photos, or being photographed at some protest. As the commune's profile grew in the media, Rainer and Uschi's relationship was under pressure. They had very little privacy, both publicly and at home. On top of this, Rainer didn't believe in monogamy. He said the thought of owning someone, even if it was just their heart, didn't seem right to him. But sleeping with the other woman in the commune, that was just fine by him for some reason. I always love to say this. It took feminism a little while to catch up to the counterculture. Because these communes in the late 60s, they touted themselves as being so progressive and like, we're fighting for the black man, we're fighting to abolish capitalism, we're really environmentalist dudes, we're here for the people, and then the women at home are like scrubbing the floor with toothbrushes. It's such a double standard.
Yeah, and Rainer always framed this as like, I love women so, so much. They're like the greatest people and I just cannot stay with one.
So Rainer was the 1968 version of like the leftist man on Twitter who's like fighting to abolish capitalism, but then he goes home and he's like, babe, I just don't want to use a condom. It doesn't feel good. He was like that.
Yes. Yes. He's like, he's still,
oh my God.
Like, his whole shtick is still the same, I want to say. He's still just, he still lives in a commune, though.
Okay.
Gotta give him that. Or in, like, I don't know if this is, like, a real commune because it's just, like, five people. Mm-hmm. And I'm pretty sure everyone has their own door. I'm pretty sure they realized that that no-door concept was just not working. A couple of weeks later, Jimi Hendrix was in town and Uschi went to see him perform. She went backstage afterwards and got lucky because he found her just as beautiful as she him handsome. They spent the night together and on the next day she took him to the commune. She thought he'd like it, but Jimi was terrified and didn't want to stay the night.
I'd be kind of freaked out by the whole no doors thing too.
That smell, man. So they went and got a hotel room, but Uschi still got what she wanted because Rainer was pretty jealous of the situation. See, when she said that her heart can only belong to one person, that didn't count.
Mm-hmm.
It's that whole double standard. Mm-hmm. In quotes, Jimi was the most beautiful man there ever was. Slim with such a handsome, evenly face and a silver necklace with turquoise on his dark skin. There's actual footage of Jimi leaving her after this weekend, and it's on YouTube for you to watch. They kiss each other goodbye, and he drives off.
We'll probably have it in, like, a trailer or something, right?
Yes.
Well, she's walking through the crowd with a circus mind that's funny.
They never saw each other again. He actually wrote her a letter, but she can't remember whether she ever replied.
Can't remember if you replied to Jimi Hendrix. That's crazy.
Yes. I feel like this is a thing about Uschi. She was never intimidated by anyone.
No, no.
She was like, okay, he's this big rock star, whatever. I'm just not going to reply here. I have better things to do. Gotta go smoke a menthol cigarette and drink a Coke.
She did the 60s version of leaving him on red.
Yeah, she did. She actually really did.
Oh my God.
Imagine him writing this letter and then waiting for weeks and weeks on end for some sort of reply.
He's Jimi Hendrix. He'll be just fine.
Yeah, probably. And it's interesting because whenever he comes up in this podcast, women just describe him as the most beautiful man ever.
Oh, yeah.
And I can relate to that. He was so beautiful.
Just
he looks like a statue.
Yes!
Yes. Everything about him was just, like, objectively perfect.
And he was nice!
Yes.
That's the big thing, because usually the more, speaking from experience, the more you find out about these rock and roll guys, the worse they become. Not with Jimi Hendrix.
He seemed to be a good guy.
From every account I've heard, he was just, like, genuinely nice.
However, she still decided to stay with Raina, and in 1970, she got an offer to be in a movie. Initially, she wanted to turn it down, but Raina managed to get her an offer for 25,000 mark, so she took it. That's actually a whole lot of money back then. Rote Sonne, which translates to Red Sun, directed by Rudolf Thome, is now a cult film about a group of four young women in Munich who lure men into relationships, only to kill them after 5 days. The story follows Thomas, who becomes romantically involved with his ex-girlfriend Peggy, one of the killers. Uschi portrayed Peggy, but didn't really enjoy acting, mainly because she thought she was bad at it. This is interesting because later she was offered a 10-year acting contract with a studio and she turned it down because one thing was that she, even though she says she's a narcissist, there are things that she was insecure about, like acting, but also mainly because she just didn't like the thought of being stuck in some sort of situation or contract for 10 years. During this time, Kommune 1 got more radical, so they built a bomb.
Oh God. Things always go sideways when they start building bombs.
Yes. They put it on the desk where it just stood for a couple of days before someone moved it to the toilet. Then the next day, the police came knocking on their door. Someone had told them that there was a bomb on the desk, but they couldn't find it because they didn't check the toilet.
How did they not see it? They have no doors!
Yes. I have no idea how this happened. This. Still, they took a couple of the men, including Raina, and put them in jail. Uschi printed flyers and visited him every day until he got out again. After this, Uschi and Raina decided to move to a different commune back in Munich. This commune was called Haifisch Kommune, which plays a pun on the German word Haifisch, which means shark and obviously being high. There they decided to plan a festival. After having heard of Woodstock, they wanted to do something just like this, and naturally the only band in question to headline this were the Rolling Stones. Raina and Uschi flew to London, where they met their old friend Peter Green of Fleetwood Mac. They'd met him a little earlier when Peter had visited the Haifisch commune, where he reportedly had one of the worst LSD trips of his life.
Yeah, the story of Peter Green at Haifisch is the stuff of rock and roll myth. No one seems to know the exact details of what happened there that weekend. Peter talks about jamming with the commune members and, like, he said he had a good time. There was a lot of acid there. That's well known. Whatever happened and whatever it was they took, both Peter and fellow Fleetwood Mac guitarist Danny Kirwan, they were never quite the same after their stay. Peter put Uschi and Raina in contact with the Rolling Stones. They dropped by the studio while they were recording Sticky Fingers. Uschi was wearing a pair of hot pants and a long fringe coat. All of a sudden, Mick Jagger appeared in front of her. "You look so beautiful," he whispered in her ear. Uschi felt all of her childhood dreams coming true. She had such a big crush on Mick when the Stones first hit it big. Raina started talking about their plans for an open-air concert, but Uschi was thoroughly distracted. She couldn't take her eyes off Mick. She also didn't really speak any English, which makes her time with Jimi Hendrix and Peter Green even more interesting. What did they talk about, if anything at all?
Her time with Jimi Hendrix, I can imagine them just not talking for 3 days straight.
Yeah.
For some reason, he seems like the kind of guy who would just, like, not talk, maybe sing a little, and they would have a great time. He seems like the kind of person where silence isn't awkward.
Oh yeah, just go with the flow, totally. Yeah.
And they were probably also very high, so maybe they did talk in some sort of language that none of them spoke.
Whatever Raina was on about, it must have done the trick. Mick signed an official letter stating that the Stones would perform in Germany. That night, they all went to see Santana in concert. That would have been an incredible show. Mm-hmm. Santana in like 1970. Are you kidding?
And being there with the Rolling Stones.
Oh, yeah.
That's just the whole package right there.
Mick and Ushi cuddled all night while Raina sat awkwardly next to them. When the Stones toured Germany a year later, Mick got Ushi's contact information through a magazine her photos were in. He asked her to come to his hotel and they spent the night together. The very next day, he left for Paris, where he was to meet his first wife, Bianca. Talk about crazy timing.
Mm-hmm. I feel like this is also part of this story that comes up over and over again. Timing is just insane. She will always meet people in the weirdest ways and times.
Mm-hmm. Over the next 2 years, Mick would come see Ushi whenever he was in Germany, but eventually he stopped reaching out. Ushi never found out why. So back in 1969, Ushi and Rainer were looking for a place to stay. They took out an ad in the newspaper that wrote, "Hippies R. Langhans and Ushi Obermeyer, not related to and strongly disapproving of the actions of hippie Charles Manson," important clarification, "are looking for large rooms, production rooms, immediately." This bizarre ad somehow worked, and they found a place. They moved in together, just the two of them, but it didn't go well at all. They found that without lots of other people around them, they were fundamentally incompatible. They broke up, but remained good friends. When Ushi's life was made into a biopic in 2007, she brought Raina as her date, and they walked the red carpet together. By the way, Raina still has the same hairstyle he did in the 1960s. He might not have washed since then, either.
I could imagine that. He also now always wears white.
Okay.
Not in, like, a cult leader way, but in a white t-shirt kind of way. But it still kind of seems cultish, because his gorgeous, majestic hair is now fully white, and so he has this, like, big curly head of white hair and then these white shirts, and he just,
oh wow,
I don't know, he also somehow managed to make a living out of just being him. I don't think he has worked like a regular job ever.
No, I could see how he would do that. Probably like lots of interviews and like, I'm holding a Zoom seminar about like this thing and the other.
Yes. And still getting asked about how the commune life was.
Yeah.
And then, oh, I have to tell you this. We talked about this book because actually this book ended up in my hands because I found it randomly at my in-laws' house, who they one day just had bought that book. And so when I talked to them last week and I was like telling them how we are recording this episode, my father-in-law was like, "Do you know that Raina ended up going to the Dschungelcamp, which is a TV show here that mostly people who are definitely past their prime are going to, and they ship them over to Australia to spend like weeks in the jungle."
It's like, I'm a celebrity, get me out of here?
It's exactly that.
Oh my God!
I didn't know that that was a thing everywhere, but apparently
that's so
it's exactly
funny.
That. And he was there, but he was voted off pretty early on because he was boring. People just didn't like it. Because I was like, this is perfect for him. It's like a communal living situation, no privacy. He must have thrived there.
I would love to see those clips if you can find them.
I'm going to try the hardest to dig something up.
In the early 1970s, Ushi developed an addiction to Quaaludes. Quote, "I was halfway gone and slowly but surely couldn't orient myself anymore. I kept walking into doors or bumping into walls. But during this time, my career truly took off." She got work offers from all over Europe and started to get paid about 1,000 mark per day. This was a lot of money back then for models. Eileen Ford, head of Ford Modeling Agency, still one of the biggest agencies in the world.
Yes.
Saw Ushi's pictures and invited her to come to the US. She did several shoots there and even went on a couple dates, but nothing made her want to stay in America. This truly surprised me. Ushi was always wanting for some big adventure. She was in New York, one of the busiest cities in the world, and it didn't make her happy. I guess it wasn't all she thought it would be.
I don't know. I feel like she never wanted to settle down anywhere. She just always kind of like moved around. She would travel for so many years, but eventually she ended up living in the US. She is now living there.
So she returned to Germany, where she started visiting Hamburg.
This is the third German city that plays a major role in her life. Initially, she went there for work, and one day someone told her about a guy named Dieter Bockhorn. And over the next couple of weeks, he kept coming up over and over again. People told her about his excursions to Africa, how he had gone water skiing at the Hamburg Harbor, and what a wild man he was. But they also told her that he was somewhat of a pervert, and that he kept his Rolex beneath his fighting fish and skulls in an aquarium.
What?
That is the most insane detail to tell about someone that you haven't even met yet. I mean, imagine going like, I have this friend called Dieter and he like keeps his Rolex beneath his fighting fish. That's such an absurd detail.
That sounds like a Bob Dylan line. And yeah. Dieter keeps his Rolex underneath his fighting fish.
That's actually pretty good.
It's so bad. If I really commit to the bit, I do an okay 66 Dylan.
Then one day she met him. He was a slim guy with a leather jacket and a mustache and beautiful blue eyes. She liked his humor and he liked her. A couple days later, she came to Hamburg again, and on the airport, he waited for her in a white Mercedes filled with colorful balloons and roses. That night, he showed her his world. Bockhorn, we will call him by his last name because Uschi did too, had a bar on the Hamburger Kiez, which is the same part of town in which the Beatles got their start. It's basically an area filled with nightclubs, bars, and strip clubs. And Bockhorn was called the King of the Kiez. He was a truly eclectic guy. While traveling through Africa, he had gotten himself a pet monkey who just lived with him in his apartment and even shared a bed with him. Soon the two were a couple, and while they deeply loved each other, there were problems from the beginning. Bockhorn made it clear that he didn't want her to have all the freedom that she was used to before. He wanted people to know that she was his girlfriend and he didn't allow her to do whatever she wanted. He also got violent against her a couple of times. But what she truly adored about him was the way that he lived life. She always felt like Rainer was just looking at life and talking about it, while Bockhorn was actually doing it. Eventually, he got a new bar in Hamburg called Café Adler, and it was an immediate hit. Starting in the morning, you could meet everyone, from pimps to the mayor there. He had his friends who were artists come in and draw on the walls, and it soon became a favorite going out spot for many. Later, the Boomtown Rats celebrated an album release there. I love that Uschi really didn't have a type.
Oh no.
She like goes from one man to the next. They're all completely different, not only in the way that they look, but also in what they're doing and how they're approaching life.
Her type seems to be extreme personalities.
Yeah, and I think she was always looking for something completely new, like all her life. It didn't matter what it came to, if these were like new places, new relationships. She was always looking for something as polar opposite to what she was doing before.
As much as Uschi loved Bockhorn, she was happy to get a break from him every now and then through her modeling jobs. Her career was still going strong. One night, after a shoot in Paris, her phone rang at 3 o'clock in the morning. When she picked up, she heard a man with a British accent. Assuming it was Mick, she yelled out his name, ecstatic he'd finally called her again after all this time. "No, no, it's Keith," he replied. The Stones were on tour again, and Keith Richards wanted to meet her. They set a date for a week later to meet up in Munich. But a couple days after this call, Mick called Uschi. He suddenly decided that he wanted to take the car to Munich and stay with Uschi the same night. This was supposedly because Bianca was flying to Munich the next day. Uschi liked the idea. 5 minutes after hanging up her call with Mick, Keith called again, suggesting the same thing. Quote, "I don't think that's possible. Mick is already coming over, so I'll take care of it," he said, and hung up at 4 o'clock in the morning. The doorbell rang, and Mick Jagger stood in front of my door. I let him in, and we barely had time for a single kiss before Keith arrived.
This is like a movie.
This is so awkward. Yes. We all laughed, smoked a couple joints, and listened to music when Mick got up to go to the toilet. Keith said, "Send him away already." I liked both of them and couldn't decide who I wanted to spend the night with, and that's exactly what I told them. As we smoked another joint, Keith eventually said, "I love that I get to say all of the words that will just, like, obliterate this show's chance for any sponsors or whatsoever."
You're good. I wrote it for you.
Oh, thank you. But like, mom and dad, I'm sorry.
Sorry, Abby's parents.
Quote, Jagger, you cunt, just leave.
It's so good.
He said that he had the right of the elder because Keith and I hadn't even been intimate yet. So basically he says, I was here first.
That's so funny. Also, the fact that these two world-known rock stars are fighting over this single woman as if she was the only person living in Munich. It's their thing.
No, but it makes sense because Mick and Keith had this, like, brotherly but also old married couple dynamic. Mm-hmm. They bicker like brothers and like an old married couple.
They got a kick out of this, I bet.
Yeah. Aside from that, Bianca was coming tomorrow, so eventually Keith left. I walked with him to the door, kissed him goodbye, and made plans to meet him the next night. This sounds like the weirdest night ever. Mm-hmm. The next day, she went out with Keith. When she returned to Hamburg, there were three men in her life, Buckhorn, Mick, and Keith.
Soon, Uschi felt like her relationship with Keith was different and deeper, and Buckhorn was mad about it. She always liked Keith, but never dared to make a move on him because of Anita and the fact that both of them were deep into their heroin addiction. This is kind of the same time that we also spoke about in the Chris O'Dell episode.
Mm-hmm. Like 72-ish.
Yes, and everyone seemed so intimidated by Anita. And this really makes me want to give her a full episode in the next season because I feel like she's so misunderstood.
Oh, absolutely.
The Stones stayed in Munich for a while and her relationship with Keith blossomed. Every now and then they flew back to London and spent a week at the Wick, as they lovingly called Ronnie Wood's house. Keith stayed there because the police were keeping an eye on his house, and that weekend, Eric Clapton and George Harrison also joined them. I love that for the longest time we couldn't escape Jim Morrison, and now we cannot escape the Layla love triangle.
No, Eric Clapton, he follows.
They visited George and Kin Fons, and she was fascinated by the underground tunnel under his lake and the light-up cave he had. She sensed that George would have liked to be with her too, but she only felt friendship between the two. She basically said that he was so far gone into his Hare Krishna phase that she
like, couldn't
didn't
relate
want it.
To him.
Yeah, she felt like he was a nice guy. She like spoke really nice of him. I bet she really liked him, but there was just nothing romantic between the two. Mm-hmm. Whenever she got back to Hamburg, she fought with Buckhorn. He was mad that she lived her life so freely, and while she really loved him, she also wanted to be with Keith. Keith invited her to go on tour with him, but deep down she knew that life with Buckhorn would be more interesting, which is insane. I'm sorry, but turning down being with the Rolling Stones because it's not interesting enough? That's such a cool
move. Such an Uschi moment.
Yes.
I'm bored by LSD and the Stones aren't interesting enough for me.
In quotes, for the Stones, music came first, second, and third. Then came women. Everything I could contribute to this circus was rolling beautiful joints. Those endless studio days. The first couple of times it was somewhat interesting, but the never-ending repetition was boring, no matter how good the songs were. So I would sit in the engineering room, fill my nose with cocaine, and watch them. But all I wanted was for Keith to pack up his guitar and come home with me.
I can honestly relate to finding the studio process boring. I could never sit through that much of the same song over and over again. Like, by the time I'm done reviewing an album for the week, I'm so done with it and I won't listen to it for months. But imagine running through these same songs for months and then having to play them for the rest of your career. I couldn't do it.
Yeah, me neither. I get why Bob Dylan is not going back to his old hits. Still, she decided to go on tour with the Stones. Keith always traveled with several suitcases, which he filled with decor and small furniture. He would start by hanging scarves over the lamps and walls to dim the lights. Then he set up incense everywhere and arranged his drugs. Keith also always carried a revolver in a wooden box lined with red velvet. His breakfast consisted of caviar and champagne, along with heroin and joints. The days were filled with rehearsals, shows, and parties, and by the end of the tour, Tour, Ushi, like everyone else, was absolutely exhausted. Bet life with the Stones wasn't as boring as she thought.
When Ushi came back to Hamburg, she was head over heels in love with Keith. He really liked her, too. He wrote a lot about Ushi in his biography, expressing how deeply he cared for her. Just like Keith, Ushi couldn't give up heroin. When she booked a modeling job, she could only stay off it for a few days, just long enough so she wouldn't look tired in her photos. Eventually, Bockhorn started using, too. After the Stones tour, Ushi kept talking on the phone with Keith. One day, he told her that Anita got mad at him because she found Polaroids of him with Ushi. Despite her feelings for Keith, Ushi still wanted to see the world. So she and Bockhorn did something social media wouldn't get their hands on for another 40 years. They decided to build a bus to live in. That's right. Ushi and Bockhorn were the original van lifers. Working on the bus proved to be difficult. Both of them were on heroin all the time. They fought a lot, so when Keith invited her to go on tour again, she happily agreed. She flew to the US and stayed with the Stones for a couple weeks. One night, she got bored and decided to call Bockhorn up. On the phone, he told her, quote, "The bus will be ready in 3 days, and I'm leaving without you. You can stay wherever you are." "I want to go to Asia too," she said, almost crying. "Forget about it. I'm leaving without you." She tried to wake up Keith, but he was fast asleep. At that moment, she knew she truly wanted to be with Bockhorn. She wrote a note to Keith and flew back to Hamburg. But when she arrived, she discovered that the van was, in fact, not ready. Bockhorn made it up out of jealousy. Yet for Ushi, it felt like she had left Keith that night and their fling was over for good. She was all in on this crazy bus life thing.
When the bus was finally ready, they entrusted their club and apartment to Bockhorn's sister, and Ushi was glad to leave town. Their first stop was Turkey. Before we continue with the route and what happened, I'd like to describe this bus to you. It was an old, beautiful, large bus, and the inside was filled with carpets, velvets, and lots of beautiful fabrics. It truly was a dream bus, and there are a lot of pictures of it online, so we recommend you checking those out. And we'll definitely also post some on our Instagram. From Turkey, they drove to Kurdistan and continued to Asia, and Ushi was finally excited that she had chosen Bockhorn over Keith. It started to feel like she had made the right decision. Life with Bockhorn was exciting, and he loved people, especially children. Wherever they were, he gathered people around him and made friends immediately. During this time, he treated her like a queen.
When Ushi and Bockhorn reached Afghanistan, they were stopped at a checkpoint, but Bockhorn came up with an idea. He'd brought a stethoscope along with him. He would pretend to be a doctor. Wearing the stethoscope while handing out placebo pills they hid in Ushi's birth control package. When they tried to cross the border into India, they ran into trouble because they were missing the papers for the motorbike and boat they were hauling. So, back in the bus, Ushi pulled out her typewriter and quickly typed up the necessary papers. Bockhorn had a stamp from the cafe and twisted it while stamping, making it look smudged and slightly official. Somehow, this actually worked, and they were able to continue their journey. From India, they traveled to Nepal. One morning in the mountains, Ushi sensed something was different. She knew she was pregnant. After telling Bockhorn, he became even more caring. However, after a few weeks, she started bleeding. The doctor advised her to stop smoking, but the bleeding didn't stop. Fortunately, they met a German couple, both doctors, who advised her to go to the hospital for a curettage.
Yeah, that's basically when you lose a child, they have to make sure that all of the, like, child tissue and everything has left your body, because if it doesn't, there you can get this like horrible infection that you can die from.
At the hospital, they confirmed she had miscarried. They planned to try for another child, but it never happened for them.
I'll keep this part of her story brief because there's so much more to come, but if you read her book, there are many wonderful anecdotes about their travels. In Jaipur, they met the son of the Maharani family. Bockhorn became friends with him, and when asked if they were married, he responded that they planned to be. Upon hearing this, the Maharani invited them over and immediately started planning an elaborate wedding, completed with elephants, camels, and an orchestra. On her wedding day, Uchi wasn't entirely sure she wanted to go through with it, but she did it because everyone had put so much work into it, and she was fairly sure it wasn't legally binding.
It wouldn't have been legally binding because they didn't file for a marriage license in their own country ever, did they?
No, I think it was more of like a spiritual wedding, maybe something compared to that. Mm-hmm. But Uchi said that she never wanted to marry him. She wanted to be with him, but because he was so violent and sometimes mean across her, she just couldn't see herself being married to him, which is interesting because she stayed with him for a long time, and I bet she would have stayed with him longer if fate would have been different for them.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, Uchi and Bockhorn had become somewhat of a celebrity couple. They sent photos back to Germany where magazines printed them and wrote about their travels. And soon their wedding pictures were everywhere.
I have to see these.
We will put them up for you, but I have them here in the book so I can show Abby. She looked like the most gorgeous bride.
Oh my God.
Right? She got married in bright red.
Completely traditional dress. Yes.
Wait, there's another. There's a picture of the two of them together. Hold up.
Wow. I mean, if you're getting married and think they were in India or Nepal at this point, you go all out.
Oh, yeah. They truly went all out for this wedding. After a total of 622 days and 55,141 kilometers, they returned to Hamburg. But Hamburg wasn't the same. The cafe wasn't doing as well, and Uchi was aging out of her regular modeling jobs. Their relationship hit another rocky patch. This time, Bockhorn was so desperate he called Rainer. This is fully written out in her book over several pages, but it was too good not to include parts of this here. So enjoy this little reenactment with Abby as Bockhorn and me as Rainer.
So Bockhorn says, I think I've hit rock bottom with her. It's been 5 years and she still doesn't trust me. Without trust, this isn't going to work.
And then Rainer replies, she has a corner inside herself. She trusts so little that she doesn't trust anyone.
Bockhorn says she started taking Quaaludes as an excuse to sleep around. I know for myself the amount my body can handle where it's still medicine. But when I'm involved, it's poison. I don't take enough for it to be poison, only enough for it to be medicine.
To which Rainer replied, someone who always takes medicine knows he still has crutches. The idea is that one day you'll be able to function without them again.
For real now, figuratively speaking, you're a saint and I'm a warrior.
I love this. It's so funny. It just...
Two drama queens right here.
Yeah, but it also just paints them so perfectly for the men that they were.
Mm-hmm.
The conversation continues for several pages in the book, but this comparison between the two is really interesting. I feel like while Uchi had a hand for unique men, she didn't really seem to have a type in particular. Especially Rainer and Bockhorn seem like polar opposites to me.
In the early 1980s, Uchi and Bockhorn decided to ship the bus to New York. They planned to drive across America and down to Mexico. Being back in the bus with Bockhorn felt beautiful, and Uchi felt the farther they got from Hamburg, the closer they became. Both had given up heroin, and their relationship was better than ever. When they reached Mexico, Uchi's life changed again in a big way. At the same time that she and Bockhorn arrived in Mexico, Keith Richards was there. They hadn't seen each other since she left the note and suddenly left him to go back to Germany. Keith actually thought Uchi was dead. There were rumors she died from the complications of her miscarriage in Afghanistan. He wrote about this in his autobiography. However, on that fateful day in 1982, they happened to be less than a mile apart. In his book, Keith says a friend who'd spent the day at the beach came back to their place and told him about this German couple camping in a bus down by the shore. They looked like eccentric hippies. Keith immediately knew it was Uchi and her boyfriend husband. When Keith and Uchi met again, it felt like no time had passed between them. Quote, I told him about the note and explained I didn't want to be a Stones victim.
She said this referring to how the Stones treated women and tore through them like Marianne Faithfull and Anita Pallenberg.
It was all very sudden for Keith. To him, it felt like one day Uchi woke up and decided she didn't want to be with him anymore. She, however, wrote that she'd thought about him every single day for years. As they talked, their flame rekindled. They realized they were still in love. Bockhorn could feel it too. He could feel her slipping away again. Uschi spent that night with Keith at his hotel room. When she returned to the bus early the next morning, it was clear that Bockhorn hadn't slept all night. It took several weeks for them to speak again. Uschi and Bockhorn decided to stay in Mexico for the holidays.
The following winter, Keith returned, and rumors surfaced that he wanted to marry someone. That someone was a beautiful blonde named Patty Hansen. On New Year's Day, Uschi and Bockhorn got into another fight because he had been drinking all night and started again the next morning. Uschi would always remember lying in bed, both of them looking at each other, and having to look away at the same time. In that moment, the love left their eyes, replaced by disappointment. Without a word, Bockhorn left on his motorbike. When he hadn't returned by the evening, Uschi grew worried. She ran downhill, and halfway down, a car passed her. It was a friend who had spent New Year's with them. He looked at her and said, "Bockhorn is dead."
Uschi broke down, hyperventilating. She said she felt like she was dying, too. The sky, which had been bright blue all day, suddenly turned to gray. While taking a turn, Bockhorn hit a Dodge truck and was thrown from his motorcycle. Uschi couldn't help but feel like he meant to do this, that he'd intentionally ran into the truck to crash. She went back to the bus and cried. Bockhorn was 45. How old was Uschi at this time?
A little younger, maybe like 35, something like that, I'd say.
When news reached Germany, the media went crazy. Reporters flooded in, but Uschi turned down every interview for the first time in her life. Bockhorn's family decided to give him a burial at sea, but Uschi kept some of his ashes in a small box. For a long time, she took him everywhere with her and held the box close when she had to make difficult life decisions. Over time, she'd scatter his ashes in beautiful places she saw on her travels, like in wild rivers and in the ocean off the coast of Hawaii.
About 10 days after Bockhorn's death, the dog started barking late at night. Uschi looked out the window and saw Keith walking up the dunes. She left the bus and walked towards him. In quotes, "We always meet at the wrong end of the stick," he said. He had heard about what happened and asked if he could help. "There's nothing to do," she said. As she moved towards him to lean on him, he suddenly stepped back, almost horrified, and said, "I'm married and I have a family." Then Keith ran off into the night. In the span of a week, Uschi had lost the two most important men in her life. For the first time, she was alone. After having what she described as a midlife crisis and financial struggles all at once, Uschi decided to go to Los Angeles, where she's still living nowadays. She has become a jewelry designer and released several books, none of which unfortunately is available in English. She still comes back to Germany occasionally to talk about her time with the Commune One, and every now and then meets up with Raina. For several years after Bockhorn's death, she went back to Mexico and slept in the bus. She said it somewhat felt like the time stood still there.
I remember telling you when we got the first version of the script, when you sent me the first version of the script, and I was so shocked by Bockhorn's death. And I'm really, really sad for her because it always sort of felt like she thought she'd always have him to fall back on.
Yeah.
But I'm also really glad that she got to live an independent life. Like, it was really hard for her at first. She struggled financially. She didn't really know what to do with her life now that she wasn't a model and world traveler. But I'm glad she had a little bit of independence.
Yeah, me too. It's interesting because she said that his death kind of like changed her outlook on life, and that now whenever she leaves someone, she makes sure to properly say goodbye and to be on good terms. She says even if she's just running to the grocery store, just in case something happens, she always makes sure to leave on good terms because she says it still haunts her how they fought and never got the chance to dissolve that in some sort of way.
Thanks for tuning in to this episode of Unveiling the Legends, Dolls of the 60s and 70s. We hope you enjoyed our journey through the wild life of the fashion model super groupie, Uschi Obermeyer.
As always, we're Emma.
And Abby.
Your hosts, and we're thrilled to have you with us on this groovy adventure. Remember, the spirit of these trailblazing ladies lives on in each one of us, inspiring us to embrace our individuality, creativity, and passion for change.
If you liked what you heard, don't forget to subscribe to, rate, and review our podcast on your favorite streaming platform. We do only have one episode left of season one after this.
And a special little something after that.
Yeah, a little fun after that. But this is Emma's last episode she's writing for the season.
Yeah.
So everybody give her a big round of applause in your ratings. Mm-hmm. And thank her so much for not only writing this episode, but translating the whole thing.
Thank you. I loved it. It was so much fun. I feel like because everything about her is only available in German, mm-hmm. people overseas just don't know anything about her life. She's mm-hmm. like this myth everywhere, because she comes up and if you look at pictures from the Stones, especially in the like early and mid 70s, she's on so many pictures, but because you cannot really find a lot about her, her Wikipedia article is insanely short. Mm-hmm. There's just not a lot there.
Your feedback means the world to us, and it helps others discover the magic of these legendary dolls.
As always, we'd like to thank special friend of the show, Michael Teggio, for the wonderful intro song. Until next time, keep the music loud, the fashion groovy, and the spirit of the 60s and 70s alive in your hearts.
Peace,
love,
and rock and roll.